Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Tēnei ka mihi ki te mana whenua o Aotearoa. And we acknowledge the local tribal authorities of New Zealand.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Darumbal country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. Finally, if you enjoy this poddy, please subscribe, comment, like or share on our social media and consider buying us a coffee if you'd like to help support our work. Now on with the show.
In season two, we had a chat about a fairly recently published book, Climate Crisis and Consciousness, Reimagining Our World and Ourselves. A very timely conversation at the time, which we half joked was a therapy session for myself. Well, 3 years on, and we feel we all need a check-in with some valuable reminders. How have we fared dealing with the increasing occurrence of climate disasters? Let's find out.
So we are so fortunate to be chatting with Dr. Sally Gillespie today for her second appearance on the podcast. Sally is an author, workshop facilitator and lecturer with a background in deep psychology and eco-psychology. As Ben mentioned, we first spoke with Sally in 2021, and since then the climate science and consequently how we deal with the unfolding climate crisis has continued to evolve. So today we're touching base again to discuss some of Sally's latest work and, as Ben mentioned, probably for a bit of therapy and wisdom on how to deal with the mental health impacts of our changing climate. So Sally, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us again.
Thank you, kia ora. Yes, I'm joining you from the land here of the Gadigal and Wangal people of the Eora Nation. So I want to add my acknowledgement here of their sovereignty and of the immense wisdom, cultural knowledge and care of country that has happened here for millennia and is an enormous source of inspiration in what we're facing today and the work that I do with others.
So Sally, since we last spoke, things have certainly escalated in Australia and other parts of the world. We're experiencing an increasing amount of climate-related, let's just go there, disasters. How have things sort of progressed for you, just generally, the work that you do? Are you finding yourself just even more stretched, more demand? How are things going for you?
Well, I probably need to answer that question both personally but also in terms of my involvement with the climate psychology movement. I mean, lots has happened since we last met, Ben. I guess we must have talked in sort of earlier days of lockdown when we were very much in the aftermath of the Black Summer fires here in the eastern coast of Australia. So that was a time where there was enormous demand for climate psychology work. And it was a time where we also had to pivot a lot to online work as a result of COVID. And, you know, this is the way with you know, interruptions and at times disasters, they necessitate new ways of working and processing and doing things. So that means as a climate, in my climate psychology work, a lot has happened because we have gone online and that has significantly extended the reach we've had to people and particularly being able to work more with people in the country. Outside of urban areas, which, excuse the plane noise, outside urban areas, which particularly in Australia, which is so vast and so spread out, has been really pivotal. For me personally, lots of very busy times, but also what's been great is there's a lot of younger people coming through, and so we're seeing a bit of a generational shift happening within the climate psychology work, and that's just a wonderfully exciting and inspiring thing to see so many younger people come in with all sorts of fresh perspectives and ideas and great energy for the work. And our focus is more and more on young people because what we're seeing is just such significant mental health crisis in young people, and a significant amount of that is to do with stress over climate change, ecological problems, and the whole systemic mess really that is going on, that is leaving young people so disadvantaged in life and feeling quite grim in some ways about the future. So that's a big part of the shift that's been going on in terms of, I think, particularly the last 6 months to a year, as the science has obviously got even graver and there has been more disasters globally. Climate psychology is in huge demand, not only in terms of people wanting to unpack things like what's an eco-anxiety, what do I do about climate grief, but also a lot of organisations are now reaching out wanting workshops or wanting some form of support for their employees, you know, particularly if their work in some way brings them fairly directly into relationship with climate science.
Now, Sally, you've recently published an article in the Explorations in Climate Psychology Journal that we'll be unpacking mm-hmm. a little bit today. And in that, you mentioned, just to set the scene for the listeners so they can kind of understand how widespread this issue is, how many Australians have been impacted by some form of climate disaster since 2019. And so that's only a handful of years, but the stats are pretty somber. Talk to us about how many people are being affected here.
Well, that's right, they are, because what we're seeing is, from research that was done last year, is that 80% of Australians have experienced some form of disaster that they are associated with climate. Something like 63% have identified having gone through heat waves, which, you know, we've had a summer, an extra summer since that research has been done, so you can well understand from what you've been through, Emma, how pervasive
that summer.
the heat waves have been. 47% have experienced flooding, 42% bushfires, 36% drought, 29% destructive storms, and so on. And what's more, in places like New South Wales, Southern Queensland, there's significant overlap, so that a number of those people will have experienced both or more, you know, two or more of those things, but particularly fire and flood have been showing up in the same regions. So it's very forefront of mind, and there was an incredible sense of tension that led into this summer around fire because of the El Nino. I know at Psychology for Safe Climate we had a lot of extra work, climate cafes and so on planned. We've been lucky in that on the East Coast, the fires have been much less prevalent. There's been more flooding, but of course there has been significant fires in South Australia and Western Australia.
And what percentage of those people will then go on to experience mental health impacts, whether that's immediately after or the more long-term effects?
Well, the figures are pretty high for immediately after. They vary. I've seen figures from anywhere from 25 to 50%, and probably that depends somewhat on the nature of the disaster and the level of support that's available and the threat to life, because that's what significantly drives the PTSD if people feel that their lives are very much in danger. And, you know, looking maybe a year after the disaster, you may see 10 to 20%, you know, of survivors experiencing PTSD. So they're really significant numbers to have, often in quite small communities.
So what are the challenges with this significant increase in terms of number of population being impacted by a climatic event and almost a direct correlation of quite a significant actually feeling sort of being affected, their mental health or well-being is being affected? Because it's one thing experiencing a fire, but did it actually affect you? But it's quite high, up to 50% is quite significant. What impact is that having on the services of such, you know, the agencies that are out there to assist?
Well, it's huge. I mean, because a lot of these areas are regional areas, so the agencies often are quite small and they're manned by local people. So, you know, often the psychologist who you might want to go see might herself have been through the fire or flood or lost property or been through a threat to her own life and be suffering from that. So that's certainly one problem. that's there. And another problem is that it's taking time to get people trained up to actually be able to deal with these particular challenges. This is a collective challenge. This isn't just one person coming in and saying, oh, I had a hard time during the fires. This is a whole community that's been devastated, and that people have been through what they've been through, but their neighbours, their family, their work colleagues have all been through it. So it's a collective crisis, and the agencies are generally set up to work individually. There's a bit of a tendency for many agencies to be given a whole package of information and be told to disseminate it. But that's not what people need, is a lecture and handouts. They're needing a whole lot more than that. So it's both having the staff on the ground and having the appropriate forms of practices for collective disaster, and particularly to be climate sensitive in their awareness, because what's happening is that when people go through the fire or the flood, which are generally being so much more intense than those on record, what, of course, they're thinking is, well, what's going to be happening next year or the year after or in 5 years? And this is my home. And if I, you know, for someone who's lost a house, do I want to rebuild? Can I rebuild? Because there's significant insurance difficulties. Not everyone gets their insurance. Not everyone's being able to afford insurance, and the insurance is going up. And so then there's many questions about home and connection to home, connection to community, connection to a sense of belonging and place. So there's a lot to unpack here. And it's not really within the provenance of most mental health trainings.
Yeah. In your article, you mentioned the need for trauma-informed programs and perspectives that recognise, you know, the gravity of the situation, but also the systemic causes that have driven the climate crisis in the first place. So can you talk to us about some of these root causes that have gotten us into this ecological mess that we find ourselves in, and why it's so important to kind of recognise that moving forward?
Yeah, so I'm talking here from this perspective of this continent, Australia, but I think a lot of what I see is also pertains to Aotearoa, where I hail from originally. And, of course, you know, these are countries that have been colonised. And Australia particularly has an ecology, a very ancient ecology. It's a very ancient land. And it has been managed through an indigenous, managed by traditional custodians based on indigenous science that has developed over, you know, 60, 70 plus thousand years, about how to preserve and nurture the soil. So what happened with colonisation came, particularly in Australia where it was extremely chaotic, and what we see in early records is that the land was very beautiful. It's often referred to as being like a magnificently farmed estate in the lushness of the grass and the cultivation of large trees and so on. And that was all managed by cultural burning, small, very controlled burnings. And that built up carbon in the soil and so on. But very quickly, through sheep and cattle grazing, through land clearing, through damming and irrigation practices, the soils fell apart, and whole ecosystems there came apart too, with the removal of trees and with the prohibition of cultural burning, as genocidal practices were in place, and certainly, you know, people not being able to go onto country to do all the care for country. So what that means is that on top of the global picture of climate change, Australia here, its ecology is very fragile and vulnerable. And we've had, you know, really significant dust storms happening for some decades now as a result. I mean, not dissimilar what happened in the States with the dust bowls and so on. And what happens when land's not cared for through cultural burning is the scrubland builds up. So you've got a lot of secondary growth. It's very scrubby, very tightly placed together sort of saplings, and they're highly flammable. So with the removal of that, that has certainly played a part in the very intense bushfires that we've seen in recent years. And there's also components of that that have also fed into the flooding challenges too.
So many communities globally, not just Australia, not just New Zealand, but most parts of the planet, the world that, that has been colonized, we as in European settlers banned a lot of ancient practices that rather than manage, I like to use the term cared for the land. Yet now we seem to be acknowledging, however late it is, we now seem to be acknowledging that perhaps we need to be leaning back on that ancient knowledge and experience. So let's talk a little bit about engaging a community approach, but a truly community approach that includes, that's all inclusive, and includes previous or original landowners.
Well, I think that's, becoming more and more apparent that is what needs to happen. And often we have that, the idea that we hear that how much of the land has been cared for by Indigenous peoples. I've heard Tyson Yunkaporta here in Australia say, yes, well, that's all very well, but, we have to do it on the weekends. We, like everyone else, are struggling to survive in this crazy neoliberal culture. So, yes, we need those Indigenous cultural practices of caring for country. And we're asking them of peoples who are dealing with significant traumatizations from colonization and who often really are struggling to keep everything together. So, and on top of that, they're having to apply for grants and do all that kind of stuff to even be often there and go through often quite a rigmarole to even get onto their country and let alone have the right to do cultural burnings and so on. However, there is certainly been an acknowledgement that that's particularly with the cultural burning, that's really vital. But I have heard Victor Stevenson, who's written a lot about this and leads that movement, talk about, it's going to take many years, decades, to actually get enough trained practitioners because the knowledge isn't universal for across the continent. It's highly nuanced for each small ecosystem. But, the areas, Tathra had very bad fires on the New South Wales South Coast in 2018, but they had already had an active group there of traditional owners who had been starting to get access to various areas to cultural burning, and the areas which were culturally burnt didn't go up in flames, and that was a very big validation of that value. And so, as a consequence, that's being more and more valued and being introduced, but it is a matter of actually having enough really trained practitioners with the knowledge of that particular area, as well as all the cultural knowledge to practice that. So it's a kind of a hybrid model that's coming in. There's some idea to do smaller burnings overall, but there's not that whole Indigenous cultural knowledge about seasons and observing the plants, and because that's been disordered by climate change. That means, there has to be a lot of observation going on to work out how to adapt to the changes, the seasonal changes that are happening. So it's like everything. It's complex, it's systemic, and it's a messy process, which is, there is certainly some evolving going on and some recognition of just how damaging colonising processes are. But also there's a lot of negotiation to be done with primarily European settler descendants farming vast tracts of land and all of that.
But to get to the point here, we acknowledge the need. You've just said there's a lot of negotiating work to be done. Mm-hmm. We're talking a lot about, okay, what are we actually doing? Because, things take time, but we don't have time. Mm. And if we're just sitting around and acknowledging that yep, we should be doing things better, but are we actually doing anything about it? Because meanwhile, especially where Emma lives, Queensland, still thousands of hectares of land clearing. Ongoing. Yeah. We're still doing this globally. We're acknowledging that we need to do things better, but heck, let's just continue down the same path. Now, that's not very engaging. We want to engage a community and say, we need your help, but at the same time, we'll still continue doing exactly what we're doing. Now, we know personally we've had representatives of the Esperance Dalarac community. I think they're, Emma, Western Australia.
Yeah.
I guess on the show, and they're doing amazing work on the land that they're caring for. And there's many other examples, of course, but they're little pockets. But everywhere else, we're still continuing to mine. We're still continuing to shout out to our listeners in New Zealand. Climatic events in New Zealand the last year with the flooding has been immense, and a lot of communities impact as well. With another European invention, forestry, and the byproduct, the slashing, and so on. So there's different forms of how we're harming not just the land, but the communities, the surrounding communities that are being directly impacted. Mm-hmm. We're not doing anything about it. We're talking about it. We're acknowledging. We're saying, yes, it's engaged, but it's so disengaging to not. The real acknowledging is by stopping the wrong things we're doing.
Yeah, I hear you, Ben, and the frustration of the fact that we do have a better understanding now and a bit more analysis, but putting it on the ground. I guess where I sit, and I'll say here, my husband, Jonathan Marshall, is a researcher in energy transitions, and we have been going out a lot into country New South Wales to do field work in various communities about the transitions to renewable energy. But many of those places have been affected by flood and fire, so I've been able to have conversations there. What we're really seeing happening here in Australia is very little at a federal level. Yes, we've had a change of government, and some of this, the figures look better than they did in terms of pledges and so on. But the actual change on the ground coming from the federal government is pretty small, and a lot of what might be being able to be done is often being prevented by regulation which is either outdated, or is, in fact, in some cases, even being, what can we say, supported by interest groups who are not keen to see transitions to renewable energies or other forms of practices. But what we are seeing is some very significant for communities initiatives, so that we are seeing solar panels funded by communities going up on surf life-saving clubs, council buildings, sewerage farms, all those kinds of things. And what seems to be happening is that on this real world level is the change is coming from the bottom up, from the community. And it does look small and piecemeal. But what happens is that each of those communities are offering models. When anything works, there's a model for another community to come in. Because centralised practice, as much as we would like to see things driven by the federal government, also does have problems, certainly in a place like Australia, which is larger, and there's really significant difference between different ecosystems and different communities. And I think, there's that frustration, but we mustn't give up. We must actually, I think, look to the grassroots, because also I know from what I do here in the middle of Sydney, I belong to a permaculture food forest, a community garden. The things we do every day, including getting out there and doing stuff around community food systems, does give us some sense of agency. Will it be enough? Well, no, probably not. But is it better than nothing? Absolutely. And it's empowering. And it also has significant effects for mental health, because we know how much people are suffering with the climate crisis, with feelings of powerlessness and feelings of not knowing what to do and what do we do. So if we can actually really support that kind of community approach, which also then, of course, holds a lot stronger when disasters do come along. And that's what we've seen in Lismore, in New South Wales, Northern New South Wales. It's what we've seen down on the South Coast. is that communities that were already quite strong through having been so involved in so many community initiatives fared better in the disasters. They still need significant help around the traumatisation and mental health, let alone all the other practical issues of housing and infrastructure and so on. That anything that strengthens community cohesion is really vitally important at this stage of where we are in terms of ecological climate crisis.
So let's follow that thread for a minute. So just putting mitigation and adaptation aside and focusing in on those community therapeutic practices. Again, in your article, you mentioned that ideally they should be led or at least conducted in collaboration with First Nations people. And you mentioned the fantastic work of Jem Stone in the Northern Rivers as a specific example. So could you maybe just talk to us about that and why it was so particularly effective for that community?
Yes, Northern Rivers, Bundjalung country particularly, that Jem Stone and her organisation We Ally, which is a training organisation of culturally informed trauma integrated healing approach, which was set up by Carly Atkinson and her mother Judith Atkinson, are both highly trained professionals in trauma work. So there was a good Indigenous hub and a strong Indigenous community up in that area. Now, within days, actually it was most significant after the floods, which was just so traumatic, and there were two of them, two ones very close together. Within days, you had two Indigenous-led organisations doing a majority of the community work. One was the Kurimail, the Indigenous newspaper that set up a kind of a hub there, even though their own offices had been badly affected. And another was the Northern Rivers Community Healing Hub, which was set up by Carly Atkinson and other people involved with We Ally, and was very much for Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to deal with the immediate effects of trauma. And they were very strong in seeing that what people needed most was to regulate emotionally and somatically. And so there was offerings around massage, that type of thing, somatic practices, and a lot of yarning or weaving circles, or actually getting people sitting down together, regulating through being in circle, using their hands very often, which is another good thing in terms of trauma regulation, and protocols of listening and taking time to unpack the stories of what people have been through. And that hub's still continuing. There's still, you know, plenty of trauma coming out of the floods. And that community approach has been absolutely vital and very much appreciated within that area. So Jem and her colleagues who have been a vital part of that. And I think very much helping to unpack the cultural side. I mean, what Indigenous healers bring us, as well as a knowledge that mental health is primarily something which is to do with community. And I know that the same with Māori in Aotearoa New Zealand, as an understanding that your individual mental health is very much to do with family, home, country, and so on, and the health of all of those systems that you are nested in as an individual.
With Blue Zones. It's all the same fundamentals.
Yeah,
it's community,
that's right.
Collectiveness,
Collectiveness and you know, any time you talk to survivors of bushfire, floods, whatever, it invariably comes up about the community, you know, that the community bonded together. Very often the larger systems, again, federally run or state run, have not really been prepared or properly funded or properly staffed to get in there. Often there's been a failure of infrastructure. In the Northern Rivers case, it was a failure of a lot of the water monitors to really pick up the levels of water that was coming down the system. So there was a failure of flood warnings. And, you know, what I hear a lot from those communities is we can't sit around and wait for them to get together down there in Canberra. We have to start to actually drive this ourselves. We have to put up our own water monitors. We have to organise the community healing hubs and so on. And because that means doing something outside of the mainstream system and the way the mainstream system works, being Indigenous-led makes so much sense because it is in tune with the needs of our time, and it has an analysis and an understanding of why the floods and fires are happening and the work we need to do in earth reconnection as part of the larger healing.
How do we foster that though? Because, you know, like, do we need more leadership and action from local councils or local healthcare systems or community groups? Because it feels like it would be insanely unfair just to expect Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander corporations or native title bodies to have to lead the charge without a thorough support system in place.
Absolutely. So, you know, and funding is a very big issue, and resources is a very big issue. So ideally we wouldn't be waiting for a disaster to come and going, oh, perhaps we should be listening to Indigenous people, but actually to see that the council has significant representation on it of First Nations people, and that the community systems do, and so on. And then that can vary considerably from area to area how that's going.
Do you also think part of that failure is the lack of place-based knowledge, in the sense that, you know, you sit in Canberra up on a hill, but the lack of understanding of the immediate specific needs in a particular community, in a particular place, based on specific environmental factors? And that's why the biggest successes come from homegrown, local, ground-up movements, because A, there's a bit more passion and sense of urgency, but also there's a bit more of an immediate understanding through the connectivity of that community to understand what people actually need at that time, rather than just a generic approach.
Yeah, and how the ecosystems work, you know, how do those water tables work, both how they worked before colonization and how they're working now, according to what kind of interventions there's been. But yes, that acts, and this, you know, this is Nicole with Indigenous science. It's all to do with observation, and observation over significant periods of time. That can't happen from a federal government. I mean, here in Australia we have state government too, which is a significant player, so we have three tiers of government, but even states cover, you know, a huge area of different kind of ecologies and ecosystems. So part of it is, you know, looking at governance so that it is more informed from grassroots level rather than actually having to deal with large imposed systems that are not sensitive to ecological and community circumstances.
Yeah. Can we just take one little step back, just for the benefit of our non-Australian listeners and perhaps for some Australian listeners? You mentioned the whole concept of creating a safe space, the weaving circles and yarning. What, not literally necessarily, but what does yarning mean? And perhaps it might even lead on to the kapati approach, but it's more than just speaking, right? It's can you just elaborate a little bit for the benefit of our listeners?
Yeah, well, I'll you know, preface that with, you know, this, you know, I am not an Indigenous First Nations person, so I can't really speak to the yarning cultural practice in any specificity. But, you know, what I belong to a community of practice, and it's a number of organisations who all in different ways practice conversation circles of some sort around climate. And We Ally is involved in that. That's how I know Jem Stone and also Georgie Ego, who works and takes an active part in this community of practice. And what has come out of our conversations with them is that there is a commonality around what cultural practice, Indigenous cultural practice, are called yarning circles or weaving circles, which is a sitting down, a really deep, respectful listening, holding that circle, being in relationship through sitting in circle where everyone can see each other, you know, and it's it seems bizarre when you look at it, how many conversations we try to have in a Western model where people are sitting in rows looking at a podium. The physicality is important, the physicality of maybe having something in your hands. For yarning is held within ceremony, you know, Indigenous ceremony. And so there will be protocols about when it happens, how it's led, and so on. So I can't speak to those. But what I can speak to is that there is a teaching that I think is available for us in the in the Western world of practice, which is about that importance of sitting in circle, opening and closing rituals, using group agreements about respectful listening and so on, knowing that these are all factors within Indigenous practice which have fed into a strong community cohesion. And that there's many things we don't have solutions for. The Western mind's very quick to not only be very linear, but to come up with and say, this is the right way. This is what we all have to do. Yarning is about sitting down and saying, here's the specific problem. You know, here's what we're contending with. What's all the observations we can bring? What's the experiences you've had around it? And allowing something to organically kind of evolve to address the specific situations that are arising, and not kind of separating that into, oh, well, that's emotional, perhaps you should put that aside for a private moment, and you know, this is practical, and you know, all those kind of separations we tend to make in Western culture. What is so important, I think, is it's a very natural thing. This is what I hear from communities who have been through significant disasters. They want to get together and tell the stories. You know, that's part of the unpacking and processing of the experience. But if it's not done safely and held safely within ceremony, within circle, within time agreements, within group agreements and so on, what happens is it can just be a flooding of trauma. My friend Joe Dodds, who's the president of the Bushfire Survivors for Climate Action, talks about what it was like to go to the supermarket after the fires. And, you know, down aisle, there'd be three or four encounters with people she'd know, and everyone would be spilling their stories, and she would come home from the supermarket just kind of very overwhelmed and drained in the end. It wasn't a good way of community unpacking what they had been through. Mm.
Following on from that, I mean, the models are becoming increasingly dire, suggestive of more severe outcomes, and as years tick by and the changes that Anita don't come to fruition, it can feel like as individuals that sometimes, you know, we're banging our heads against a brick wall, basically. It can feel quite pointless continuing on with what we're trying to do if the big businesses and the governments aren't acting in accordance with the science. And you spoke quite eloquently last time you were on about the concept of grounded hope, and we probably all need a nice reminder of this concept. But you know, when a person gets to the point where they feel overwhelmingly gloomy after having these conversations with everyone that's trying to do their bit as well, how do we avoid burnout? Like, how do we avoid losing some of those wonderful people out there that are fighting the good fight, but they just feel like they're on the brink of giving up because they don't feel like they're getting anywhere?
Yeah. Look, I think in some ways we have to take a little bit of a step back to the way we frame and understand the situation we're in now. It's probably even more clear than when we last talked that we are in a place of systemic crisis, and the world, both ecologically and in terms of the kind of cultural changes that are also coming along with all of this, is changing in ways that will never be... We won't go back. We cannot go back to how it was. And that I think, you know, this is where often Indigenous teachers talk about deep time and having an understanding that we are born into the times we're born into. And the times we are born into now are times of huge changes and shifts, some of them very chaotic, very, very crisis-ridden. But also some really strong understandings about how the cultural paradigms which have become dominant globally in the last hundreds of years through colonization and extractivism and so on, all those kinds of practices that drew on Enlightenment thinking, have taken us to a point of burnout as a planet. And that it is our job, if you like, our mission, our calling, to participate in these times with this knowledge that we are here to be part of a huge shift and change. I think for a long time, many of us in the climate movement were spending a lot of trying to stop making this happen, you know, trying to stop it all. And it's gone past that now. So we need to shift our narrative and our understanding. We need to, as Bayo Amakolofe, I think is the right way to say it, the environmental philosopher, often says, make haste slowly. That we're going to be living with this for the rest of our lives, whatever age we are, and to pace ourselves, basically, and to understand that retreat, times of caring for ourselves in ways that we're particularly called to care for ourselves is not a giving up, is not an opting out or any of those things. It is part of the cultural shift we need to be in, because if we hadn't been in a burnout culture, a burning out, you know, so desperately trying to use up all the resources and grow the economy and all those different things, we would be following the traditional ways of indigenous cultures, which are very much to do with renewal and sustenance, and working with time cyclically rather than with linearly. What concerns me a lot these days is the talk of collapse. There's a lot of talk of collapse, and that seems to be an increasingly common narrative to think about where we are. It's not that I contest that we're not in a time where things, you know, I think I'll go with Tyson Yugapolta, we're in for a rough ride. Yep, we're having a rough ride and things will not be the same, and we have to do a lot of adaptation work and evolution work and all the rest. But I think talking about collapse, perhaps too much, or making it your main narrative around this time, invokes a sense of collapse, indeed, for you personally, because it feels, you know, like there's nowhere to go. It's just all ending and finishing and will be disaster. I think if we think about becoming more grounded, that gives us a different sense of task about now. Being more grounded about where our food comes from, where our energy comes from, what's actually possible to keep going with and sustaining, at least puts, you know, some earth under our feet. And perhaps it honours a bit when we need to go to ground ourselves, to rest, and to think, because the big problem now is there's an awful lot of trying to find solutions from that same mindset that drove the problem. And, you know, I know even in environmental organisations there can be real burnout issues, because there, you know, there's a lot of deadlines, there's a lot of goals, there's a lot of sense of urgency that is breeding a culture which does not necessarily have the time for deep thinking and deep connections, which is so very important. So it's no easy answers here, but I do think it is really important to think about how we use our narratives and the kind of metaphors and thinking so that we can stay, so put ourselves in a place which is realistic in that grounded sense, but also gives us ground to proceed from. Mm. And I think, sometimes it's the thinking that's going with what we're trying to do that becomes very exhausting.
The overthinking. It's very sound and you know, good advice coming from you, of course. But it's a struggle to. I understand what you're saying, but it's a struggle to accept that that is the way forward for my own well-being, for our own well-being. I have concerns for a lot of good people that we're well connected to in the climate movement. They are at a point of precipice in terms of really struggling. You know, they very much still involved, but it is impacting. You know, the urgency, the collapse in some ways needs to be there because, you know, New Zealand's just had a government change, and we're still going backwards, even more backwards. So how do you action people into making those changes? You've got to get more aggressive, but it's not just marketing saying, oh, let's just use the right words. It is, you know, every month is the hottest month on record. It is accelerating. So there needs to be that urgency. So it's that flip side. Talk about being grounded. Having these conversations, I always say, gives me a bit of a buzz. These amazing people doing great work in the community. We're in good hands. We shut down. I log off. As soon as I head out, I step outside of my bubble and I'm back into the open wide world and I look around me, no one has a clue what's going on and no one could give a shit, basically. So we need to be, but how long can we keep that up for? Yes, you've said it. We can't. It'll break us if it's not already breaking us. So it's a very hard balance. You know, you spoke last time about, again, we're kind of repeating a little bit here, but, you know, part of the lack of the inability to initiate climate-related conversations is sometimes around two kind of streams. One is the internal factor, our emotional sort of well-being and balance and so on, and the other was at the social level. Do you think that's changed much? Because I don't feel like it has.
No. Look, let's talk a bit of politics here, and I just want to say to you over there in Aotearoa, I really feel for you because we went through a really shit government for a really long time here in Australia. And though our present government's still got a lot to answer for, it's not the same as having a right-wing government that's intent on dismantling really hard-won, hard-fought-for advances that have happened in terms of race relations, you know, te reo Māori acknowledgement and environmental kind of steps forward. And that's it affects you in your soul when your government is being so actively destructive as so many right-wing government agendas are. And I know I felt it felt different the day after the election when we got rid of the Liberal National Party, even though, you know, as I said, we still have our battles here. But politically, the landscape is more polarised and it's more politicised, and that makes it a lot more complex. The polarisation and the way the right wing is exploiting people's immense fears. I think we need to stop talking about people out there, you know, don't care, haven't got a clue. I think there's a lot of knowledge that's been there unconsciously, but with failing the lack of leadership to show the courage to face up to it and the lack of good explanation and an active encouragement to keep participating in a growth and economy and a consumerist identity and way of life and all of those things. We're up against hard things to sway the populace. I feel our job in the climate movement is to stop talking so specifically at times in terms that haven't worked before. You know, it's no good just throwing the statistics at everyone and expecting the light bulb to go on. That's not how it's working. However, what you do see in ground-up initiatives, and we've seen it a lot here in country New South Wales, is we see people coming from right-wing conservative voting blocks who are getting behind things like solar panels. You want solar panels on your fire sheds because when the fires come through, they all have the energy and the pumps will keep going. So again, a grounded narrative can help. And this is what Catherine Hayhoe talks about a lot too. I don't know if you know Catherine Hayhoe's work. She's from evangelical Christian and climate scientist from the States. And she works particularly with Christian communities to bring them on board with climate action. And she says, don't do a whole lot of climate talk, but talk about the benefits that will come for your community from solar panels. Talk about the health impacts, perhaps, of you know, increased floods, heat waves, or whatever, and present grounded initiatives that people can get behind without saying, well, I will then cease to be able to be in my community of Christian folk or traditionally right-wing aligned country alliance or whatever, because we know a lot of the resistance to the changes, people feel they'll have to lose all their alliances, their identity markers, if they embrace and become climate science friends. Now, we know the right wing is now weaponizing and coming into environmental forums, and, you know, it's happening a lot here. The wind farms will be disastrous because of what they'll do to the bird life and all the whale migrations, and the wind farms will drive you crazy with the vibration frequencies, all that sort of stuff. So we really, there's some fairly significant things to do. But what we're hearing from communities can get stirred up, but the statistics are showing that there's still that support there. Underneath, people know we have to live in a more ecological way, sensitive way. It's presenting some of the actions that need to be taken in ways that people can come on board with without feeling they have to totally change their sense of who they are and who they connect to. So this is where we see a lot more sensitively, psychologically informed initiatives going on, and I think a lot of the environmental organisations do have some understanding of that. Particularly, I think, because in Australia we're having to deal with transition. We're having to talk to mining companies. We can't demonise people who work in mines. They are working in mines because there's no other work there, and the pay is good, and those mining companies make sure that they sponsor every community organisation in that community. It doesn't mean that people feel comfortable about that, but they're, you know, what they need is alternatives and a pathway that is credible towards those alternatives. They don't need to be, you know, shouted at or belittled or feel, you know, that they're stupid because they're not responding to the climate science. That's where community work can make a real difference, and you can see communities, they might really get behind, and often do through experiences of catastrophe, of going, well, we need to be a bit more independent about our energy. We need to be a bit more independent about our food systems. We need to, you know, so it's starting to think more regionally and locally. And Indigenous elders tell us we need to think in bioregions. We need to, you know, these lines that have been cut across maps of country have often very little sensitivity to the bioregions of a river system or so on. And people who have lived in areas, whether Indigenous or non-Indigenous, and have a love of land because that's their sense of rooting and belonging, do have common ground there. And so we've got to do a lot of looking for common ground. We probably have to look at what the right wing are doing so successfully to stir people up and bring along and go, well, what are we missing in our narratives? The right wings, which are funded, as we know, by American, a lot of money is coming out of America, it's fossil fuel money, it's set up into think tanks. They've got some pretty sophisticated strategies for communication going on there. We're wanting to bring people together, not divide people. But we do need to know how to appeal to people's sense of emotions and the meanings and values and connections and belonging to bring people into change, which is, you know, habitually resisted.
You talk about adapting the narrative, which might already answer the question I'm about to ask, really, but taking it one step further with just straight up climate deniers. Like if we've got someone in our family that is that way inclined, or a friend at work, or whatever it may be, and we're trying to foster these conversations and bring community together and get this change going on, how do you recommend to engage with climate deniers? Do you still try and have that conversation, or just...
Yeah, it's a good question. How much energy do you put in that direction? We now know that it fluctuates a bit, of according to what's going on and who's been in people's ear, but they're not a very big part of the population, the out-and-out dark right climate deniers. Most people,
they're just more vocal at times. That's the problem.
And they're funded and they're very visible on social media. And we get people who, it's their full-time job to hop on X or whatever it's called now, and just hammer people. That's a very nasty, but it's a very small but well-funded section. I wouldn't be wasting my energy on someone who's doing that sort of thing. I think, we've got to look after our energy, and you're not going to see a change there, especially if they're actually being paid to do that sort of work. However, many people call them perhaps climate skeptics rather than climate deniers. They're sitting on the fence a bit and, not really sure. There is a lot of confusion, that's for sure. So I'm not saying never talk climate science or statistics, but don't talk too soon and get your relationships sorted. If you can find common ground, that's good. I mean, the climate deniers that we really have to worry about are the ones that are in very influential positions, not your average, not Uncle Ben at the Christmas table, who might be, enjoying stirring you up anyway.
I think it's the same approach with the plant-based movement. You don't need to say anything, but you book the restaurant, it's fully plant-based, and then people are like, wow, this was amazing. See?
Exactly.
You're converted. And I think that's the approach of doing, right, rather than simply presenting statistics, data, graphs, charts, etc., and scaring the hell out of people, because we kind of do in a way, but it is also disengaging. I think, the doing part, and that's where there's a lot of good stuff happening in our communities, a lot of small groups, from beach cleanups to planting trees to more meaningful uplifting activities, movements, and so on. So from yourself, Sally, what would be, some key takeaways from this in terms of, okay, I need to change my sort of mindset a little bit of my attitude, a little bit too negative, I'm too focused on the bad stuff. What would be some good key takeaways in terms of finishing this listening to this episode, and this is what I'm going to focus on? This is going to be my new approach.
Always a key takeaway we have from the climate psychology world is connect to others and have some really good conversations. We can't throw ourselves into any activities without a kind of feeling of fuel, of support and belonging and connection. I haven't mentioned it, but the climate cafe movement is being unrolled by various climate psychology movements. I think XR's used it a lot too. See if you can get yourself into, if you're carrying a lot of climate grief and climate fear, log on to Psychology for Safe Climate. We have climate cafes. They're New Zealand time friendly. I'm sure there's climate conversation circles of different sorts happening throughout New Zealand. They're certainly happening in Australia now. They're very accessible. This will depend a lot whether you're in a family or a set of friendship circle or relationship or whatever where you can share these fears, or if you're feeling a bit isolated. We hear a lot of stories of isolation. So I think before you try and pressure yourself to anything, get connected. Find people who you feel you can share how you feel around this and how you understand this. And then from there, start to look at what initiatives you might want to get into. They don't have to, address directly bringing down greenhouse gas emissions. The climate crisis is nested within an ecological crisis. So any forms of ecological care will very likely help build resilience into our home, our Mother Earth. So it's really important always to match up where you do with a sense of passion and connection. I mean, I'm down at the community garden and the food forest because I love having my hands in earth and gardening. And we don't talk climate all the time, but we have a general understanding that we want to do the right thing by the earth and that growing food is good and, you know, except that some people will have quite a sophisticated analysis of what's happening and why they're there. Others will be there just because it feels good and there seems to be a nice bunch of people and we need every one of them. So that's a, you know, those are two big things, the connection thing, being able to have the conversations, things that go, you know, just torture you at 4 a.m. in the morning feel very different when you can say them out in the circle and people go, yeah, I've had those thoughts too. And yeah, that happens for me also. And it's amazing how alleviating that can be. And there's something about a group where you're never all in the same place at the same time. So that actually breeds that kind of collective knowledge making and collective understandings, being able to listen to one another. That's there. I mean, understand it's a cultural, countercultural move to get connected with people. You know, neoliberalism loves to individualize people and separate people, leave them more vulnerable and more prone to, you know, more being pushed more into that consumer identity. So, you know, even if it's a trip to the op shop, I appreciate that that's a part of an understanding of how we want to live now, and take that as a political and cultural political defiance of what you don't like about what's happening a bit in politics of this world, because we kind of have to collectively dream up other ways of doing things, and you know that dreaming needs to be grounded in doing things differently as well as dreaming them differently. I don't know. Is that enough takeaways? That was a bit long for a takeaway list, wasn't it?
Not at all. I mean, you covered two key things there that we actually do repeat a lot on our episodes and have for a number of years. One is we love referring to the kapati approach. You know, make yourself a cup of tea and have a conversation. And what you've reminded us, a conversation is not just about talking, it's about listening as well and sharing. And that leads on to the other approach, which is the collective approach of a community. And community doesn't just mean a dot on a map and that's a community there. A community could be shared interests in something, mm-hmm. or, you know, there's a common goal or output for that group, and that's a community. So, but the collective approach, we always say, amounts to a lot more. And as such, I'm going to make mention of a community group effectively that I'm really growing this year, and that's Athletes for Nature. So there's a more targeted audience there for outdoor enthusiasts that not just care about the environment, but want to take action. And that's been kind of simmering the last few years, but over the next few months, so by the time this podcast is out, our first running camp would have happened, but that's a mixture of running on trails and then Katiakitanga workshops, environmental stewardship. So having, and this has just reminded me, I need to tweak things a little bit and make it more group rather than a leader with a PowerPoint presentation. But that's the aim, is as you share, you know, the passion for the nature, but what can we as athletes actually, how can we change our behaviors and how can we influence others to actually care for that? So that's one thing, but the other is a webinar series, which is educating people, inspiring people to make change. And Emma is one of those guests. But yeah, three part series, three Wednesdays. So by the time this is published, actually probably good timing. So it's a three part webinar series, Wednesday evening, 7 p.m. New Zealand time. So it's great for Australia as well. Yeah. Dr. Mike Joy, scientist, is the first one, 10th of April. Damien Hall, who we've also had on the show, a very well-established ultra runner and climate activist. He's on the 17th, and then followed by Emma on the 24th of April. So there's a lot more we want to do for that community. It's a big gap here in New Zealand, and I'd love to see that expand into Australia. But that's a community as an example, and there's a lot of others with different interests. So Sally, thank you so much. Round two. And I also want to just remind everyone, the book we refer to, Climate Crisis and Consciousness, I'm holding it up here for Sally to see, still have it, still very relevant, still a very important read. So we'll put this in the show notes, a link, but still encourage people, if they haven't yet, buy this book. It's really soothing and kind of comforting, and gives us a lot of that hope coming from that book as well. So Sally, thank you so much. Much needed, and really lovely to have you back on the show. Update us on things, how I've progressed, but really the message is the same. So it's good to reinforce a lot of the same message. Thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to having you back again sometime soon, I'm sure. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Emma. Thank you so much, Ben. It's just been a real joy to connect to you both and to really, you know, be able to sink deep into talking, because your own reflections and obviously extensive conversations with many others is kind of producing a wonderful guide for people to feel into how to think and connect and act and be in these times.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.